Ladies and gentlemen, fellow slaves of the plantation, welcome to the Vinny Eastwood Show. It's Vinny with a Y because it's the most important question, and Eastwood, like, go ahead, make my news. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? The Vinny Eastwood Show. The only thing worse than the truth is Vinny's jokes. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio for all of the GCSB and SIS and CIA and NSA that I know you've been craving this, you know, it's bad for you, I know. You look at the Vinny Eastwood aisle when you go through the supermarket and you think to yourself, well, that's very tempting, but it'd be so bad for my thighs. Now, my very special guest today is Dr. Huhana Hickey, who is a smooth operator. Huhana, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Never been accused of being a smooth operator before.
Well, when you're in a wheelchair, you can't be anything but. Now, would you mind, giving us a little bit of background on who you are and what it is you do?
Oh, kia ora. My name's Huhana. They call me Dr. Who for short. I reckon that's the only reason I got my PhD, because I'm a bit of a Whovian. What do I do? I have a background in human rights law, psychology, and that's what I got my PhD in, was law and tikanga Māori. I'm currently lecturing at AUT in Auckland, and as you can see, I'm in my teaching environment right now, but I've got a break, so perfect timing. I'm a bit of an activist, a bit of a stirrer, bit of a troublemaker sometimes.
Now, the first time I met you was actually at the medical marijuana march. I believe it was last year, around around this time last year, actually.
That's right.
Instead of doing your speech in your wheelchair, you actually wanted to stand up, and me and another another guy gave you a hand and stuff, so showing a bit of strength there. So the concept that we really wanted to discuss today is cannabis, and a lot of the some of the elements that I wanted to really talk about is moral turpitude. Like, if you've got people who are suffering and dying, and you have the ability to help them, and you choose not to, that's evil, right? In my opinion. And the other element here that we got is a broad brush public ignorance based upon the statements of these quote-unquote evil people who do what I just mentioned.
Yes. Well, you know, ironically, when I started on this journey, I was very anti recreational cannabis. And I wanted to see tight regulation. And I think part of it was informed by the fact that Māori have a major problem with being jailed for being for drugs and alcohol and the health outcomes. And but I have to say that my thinking has shifted rather dramatically as I've gotten further into the journey. I found that medicinal cannabis works very well for me, but I'm also finding the cost to be hugely exorbitant, and the generic products that are available don't meet all my needs, and they won't meet the needs of many people because it's too generic, too broad. You need individualized items, or you need individualized strains to suit the need for your condition as you need it. And the problem you've got with that is we don't have that available. I now believe that we need to be able to self-grow or have access to green fairies, and that the recreational market can easily financially support the medicinal market. So that if you wish to for recreational, that there be rules, no access for children if it's got THC, limited access for women who are pregnant, but education and health can sort a lot of that out. And then what we have is a medicinal arm that you're listed under medicine, you have a practitioner who's a specialist in developing these products for your needs, and that they can assist you with the medicinal for free whilst being able to sell balms and cookies and a whole range of products for a cost to the market. It's also part of the reason that my mind has changed on that is that alcohol is more damaging, and the synthetic psychoactive drugs that are out there at the moment that they're calling cannabis when it's not is also killing people. We have to look at something. We've got to look at it urgently, and I believe the only way forward is if we legalise in New Zealand, provide some guidelines and limitations on age and guidelines around the use of, but allowing us to dictate that market. New Zealand has the environment, we have the skills, and we have the ability to do that. And that's what I believe.
But unfortunately, we have corrupt roadblocks in the way. For yes. example, Peter Dunn, who is allegedly tied to alcohol and tobacco lobbies. We haven't been able to dig up precise evidence on that, so he's simply good at covering his tracks. Now, he's the one who systematically for the last decade agreed with each and every successive parliament that he's been a part of to have no forward movement, more or less, on the issue of medicinal or recreational cannabis, for that matter. And guess who the manufacturer of the synthetic cannabis in New Zealand is? His son!
Well, his son's the lawyer for the manufacturers, and there's a conflict of interest there, and that needs to be recognised. I don't think it's so much Dunn that's holding it up. It was actually John Key and Bill English who are totally against. And doesn't matter if you're in coalition, Peter Dunn is only one person, and the leaders of the National Party are saying no. And that's a huge problem with the election coming up, that when people are voting, and if they want to legalise medicinal cannabis, then they need to look at who they're voting for. And there is one party that's blocking that, and that is the National Party. They've said no, they will not legalise. There are members in the National Party that are actually for it, but the leader himself is not, and that's the big problem. What we've got to do is we need people to get very clever with their voting, and MMP is the best environment we can get. If we were clever, you vote for the party that's got the strongest policy, but then you vote for the individual you choose to vote for. People don't know how to do that, and I think we've got to send a strong message. I did feel that the announcements the last 2 weeks around different parties and what's going on is opening the door up more to change than what I've seen for the last few months, and that we may actually be closer towards legalisation or at least decriminalisation than we have been at any other time in New Zealand's history.
One can only hope.
I'm hoping.
Well, what happened is, as Aomer said, do not trust to hope. It is forsaken in these lands. Now, there is what was the other thing I was going to say? Is it's about in terms of being able to grow yourself and things of that nature. It's not necessarily voting that I'm feeling is actually going to change this. It's not like MMP some sort of silver bullet. If we weren't living in a prime ministerial dictatorship, if we had human rights in this country, we would already be able to grow our own cannabis without those problems.
We need to be sensible. I mean, how much harm can a balm do, for goodness sake? If, you know, balms, I tried it. From bursitis and
sorry, Huhana. Can you stop right there? Can you just start what you said again? There's a little bit of a glitch.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't understand how a balm could be illegal because it has CBD in it. I mean, CBD absorbs, THC doesn't. So it doesn't even matter if you apply THC, it won't work. But the CBD does. And what I find really weird, I got sent some balm and I tried it. And I was in terrible pain. And within 5 minutes, I'd forgotten. And it was half an hour later, I realised I'd applied the balm and I'm not in pain anymore because I just carried on, did what I was doing. But the pain had gone. And so why are we not allowing balm, edibles? They're not dangerous to have edibles. Why are we not looking at those? Because the only option people have, which is still illegal, is smoking. And the two legal ones that are out of the price range. But when you smoke, you lose 70% of their medicinal effect. And it creates the psychoactive effect. Now, I'm not saying smoking's not an answer for medicinal, but I am saying that there's so many other options and they're not dangerous at all. So what are they afraid of when they won't allow those very benign but very healing options in?
They're afraid of cutting into the profits of the pharmaceutical industries for which, if you have any kind of health disability in this country is the first and last port of call for all New Zealand-trained medical doctors who were trained in our medical system under the Rockefeller model of medicine, which is a pill for every ill. The body cannot be encouraged to heal itself. Only doctors can do that, but it's illegal to cure you, and we can only give you illegal, we can only give you incredibly dangerous drugs that haven't been tested yet on animals or something or anything like that and haven't passed any safety trials, but we're just going to give them to you anyway. And then when you die from them or commit suicide from your antidepressants, we go, oh, they must have just had problems with it or something. You know, let's just blame the people that we gave the drugs to as opposed to the drugs we actually gave them.
Well, I was on 100, over 100 drugs a day. And it was morphine, gabapentin, tramadol, codeine, DHC, continuum, paracetamol. Did you know I'm only on one Sativex at the most, about three times a week now? All the other pain relief is gone. I'm on two other regular drugs, omeprazole, Losec, and Zoplacone, one, three of them. The rest are supplements, magnesium and that type of thing, all health supplements. Now, that means that the pharmaceutical, Pharmac, no longer have to subsidise me for those drugs, but they're refusing to pay for what's working. And it comes down to their own prejudice. And there's two board members on Pharmac who need to go because they won't open their mind up to the legalisation. I don't know the names, but I know that there are two doctors who sit on the Pharmac board that are vehemently opposed to medicinal cannabis. And while they've legally allowed Sativex and Tilray, they're refusing to allow any subsidising. And I think that's a problem. I also believe that our pharmaceutical industry will save an awful lot of money with the removal of a lot of those drugs from people's daily routine. And it means that they can then put that money into some of the drugs that are really expensive for things like cancer, for some of the things that do work that are out of the price range of a lot of people, and allow us the cheap access to medicinal cannabis. It will save money, but they don't see it.
Well, the article that I read out on the show a couple of weeks ago was about the introduction of new cannabis products and CBD oils and things like that were now available for prescription. And a friend of mine said that he was able to get one from the some apothecary in Kingsland or something like that in Auckland here.
Yeah.
However, after going through the article and applying my cynicism first and then my logic second, I found that my cynicism was more logical than my logic. So so you go, okay, what are they going to do? They're going to tell everybody, oh, you can get it now, but they're not going to subsidize it. They're going to keep it prohibitively expensive, and there'll be bugger all people that would actually prescribe it anyway. And therefore, it's like doing nothing at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the hypocrisy that exists within our system, because what we're doing also is we're shoring up what is essentially a Western-based health system. When Chinese medicine acknowledged many, many centuries beforehand the benefits of medicinal cannabis, and Maori medicine had a similar which numbed everything they used. And also other cultures have been using cannabis. Indian culture have been using cannabis for many, many centuries.
That's why
in
the
that's
why it's known as Ganja, after the Ganga River, which used to have a lot of cannabis growing on it.
Exactly. And also, we only really allow a Western framework to inform us around our medicines and the application of healthcare. Why are we not looking at options and alternatives? I mean, you know, it's as simple as saying, instead of giving a drug for pain all the time, why not have access for someone to get access to even the cost of a spa pool so that they can actually have a spa once a day, which would relieve their rheumatisms or their arthritis, and be able, and that would work out cheaper as well than having anti-inflammatories. I mean, there's a whole bunch of options we could take, but we take the Western road. And it's not the best road for implementing good health for people who don't want to rely on chemicals for well-being.
Now, I want to give a plug here to James Corbett from the Corbett Report. I just watched a video that he did some time ago called Rockefeller Medicine. Now, initially during the late 1800s, there were a number of different practices that were considered Western medicine. Homeopathy, chiropractic, even acupuncture was starting to be used in Western culture. Now, the Rockefeller Foundation started to create drugs out of oil derivatives based upon the allopathic medicine model. Allopathic medicine came out of bloodletting, you know. Do you know what bloodletting is, ladies and gentlemen? It's when you think you've got bad spirits in your blood. So when you're sick, they cut you open and you bleed heaps and that'll cure you. And in actual fact, it wound up killing a whole lot of people. And then they also had surgery without anesthetic and things like that. Allopathic medicine killed the majority of people that had the surgery. And so Rockefeller Foundation hires this guy named Flexner to conduct the Flexner Report. He goes around to all the medical schools in the United States and grades them as from good to bad. And guess which medicine schools all got really good ratings? The ones who taught the Rockefeller model of medicine and the allopathic model of medicine. Everything else got given a very severely bad rating. And then, come 1950s, allopathic medicine became not only the first above all, but virtually the only medical practice that you can really access in the United States. And we've been suffering under a Rockefeller medical monopoly globally ever since, including in China during the 1950s when Rockefellers financed a bunch of spokespeople to tell the Chinese nationals essentially that their style of medicine was better than Chinese traditional medicine. And then they started to adopt, and here we are.
But ironically, we are returning to alternatives. And, I mean, they even now apply leeches again to cure certain conditions or to relieve certain conditions. So leeches were seen as a weird way out thing, but they do apply them again now, and it's working. So with better knowledge, new technologies, new understandings, some of the older practices are actually returning because they work, and they have always worked. And it's a bit like when women were midwives for many centuries, then men came along and became doctors. Then what they did is removed women from midwifery and made men the midwives through being called, what is it?
Middlemen?
Well. But they became the doctors who dealt with women, and they put women in stirrups, for instance, to give birth. And what's happened now is women now walk and stand up to give birth, or they do other methods because we've gone back to things that work. And so instead of throwing everything out, the baby out with the bathwater, we need to be examining some of these alternatives and say, maybe some of these do work, and return them. And one of those things is medicinal cannabis. We had them in New Zealand. Do you know doctors used to prescribe to the old emphysemics a certain cigarette in the 1920s and 30s because it had cannabis in it and it opened the airways of emphysemics. And so,
what were those? The what were those? The lucky strikes.
I think it was the old camels, actually, but I can't remember the name of it. But we also, if you look at the old medicines, they had cannabis in it. They also had morphine, laudanum, and a whole range of heroin and cocaine and a whole heap of stuff. But the point is, they had cannabis in it. Pharmacists used to make them up. Now, why can we not have a similar model of dispensaries, but made up of those experts out there that know how to mix the different strains, know how to grow the different strains, and know how to make the balms, make the oils, make the edibles or the medibles? And why can we not, therefore, start experimenting with something more natural, but returning back to some of those things? Western medicine on its own does not work in the current form it's in. People dying of cancer, Helen Kelly, good example, our Kiwi girl, who passed away, but she lived longer than they expected, and she died a good death because even though she was dying, she was able to die where it was really only the last week of her life that she'd stopped, lost contact with people. All that other time, she was in contact helping people and living fully by having cannabis for tea in a drink, or having it as a balm, or taking it as a medible or as an oil in itself. And it sustained her and gave her a quality of life she would not have had on morphine and all those other drugs out there that kind of take that away. If we're going to talk things like euthanasia, if we're going to talk things like dying with dignity, can we not talk about also, well, I don't want to be euthanized, but I would like to know that I could have a very good death using medicinal cannabis as a process of helping me die with a good quality of life, you know, with less pain, a bit more cognitive, and be able to do the things I want to do as I go to that journey at the end of my life. And I'm now of the mind that I can't afford to buy any more of the legal form. And so I'm of the mind that I may have to explore going illegal. And it's simply because I'm not prepared to go back to morphine, gabapentin. I'm prepared to break the law in order to, because it is unjust. And I'm prepared to do that. Now, I haven't been because I don't want to, because of my work, but I may not have a choice. So it's something I have to consider. And I think that's really unfair for anyone who has to make the choice, who's otherwise law-abiding, to have to go down an illegal road because they have no choice for their health and well-being.
You know what's problematic is a lot of people go, oh, well, life isn't fair. And you just go, look, there's a slight difference between life not being fair for everybody and life being a right scumbag to most people, all right? You know, that's the thing.
Well, you know, the 1%ers like to make our life easier. They like to make our life more unfair. They have the resources, the money to get all of this. And they can be as illegal as they like, corrupt as they like. But as soon as a poor person who wants the same access and wants the same quality of life, we're told life isn't fair. Well, I've got news for you. We can redistribute our wealth a lot fairer than what we're currently doing. How about charge the water companies for the water they're stealing out of our pristine waters? How about charging the corporates a fair tax for being in our country instead of charging poor people secondary tax for wanting to have a second job? How about redistributing fairer? And then life will, it will never be fully fair, but at least we have a better say over it.
Yeah. Well, it's prioritization. It's like, do you prioritize the $1.2 billion worth of unpaid corporate tax, or do you prioritize the $30 million worth of unpaid benefit fraud? Let's pick on those
beneficiaries. Kill them! Kill them!
Considering the level of investments that the National Party members have, in foreign companies and in our water rights and in a whole range of other things, they are really not that interested in fairly taxing the corporations. They're very interested in jailing a woman who, or penalising, say, a single parent who had to take in an extra boarder in order to feed her kids, than they are in getting Peter Thiel to pay his fair amount of tax in this country when he doesn't even live here, but he's got permanent residency. The corruption is huge. When the Prime Minister's wife wins a contract for suicide prevention because she sits on the board that got the tender by the government, you have to ask yourself, why did Lifeline lose the $800,000 when they've been around a lot longer and been doing, well, you know, they saved my life a few times. Why does it that the Prime Minister's wife, that people don't see the conflict of interest between that and him being Prime Minister and them getting a $1.3 million contract or something?
I love the timing of it as well.
We have to be asking these questions.
The timing of it was brilliant. Announcement. New Zealand, highest suicide rate in the frickin' world for teenagers. And what do we do about that? We cut funding to suicide prevention.
Absolutely. That really makes sense, doesn't it? That's the thing I'm having a problem with, not just for medicinal cannabis, but the problem I've got is the gatekeepers are feathering their own future nests at the cost of every Joe and Joanne that lives in New Zealand, at the cost of anyone coming here.
Now, I had an investigative journalist, Ben Vigen, in my office here just this morning. He's been staying here for a couple of days, and we've done some incredible work exposing a lot of the scumbaggery of this country. But what the real problematic issue is the public ignorance of the scumbaggery in this country. We cannot actually change the reality of this country until people accept it.
People seem to think it's okay for the Prime Minister to make claims on rent on his own property that he owns and then just to pay it back and nobody worries about it. But, oh, no, Materia was trying to feed her child and ended up having a boarder and not declaring that boarder. But, oh, no, she can't lead. But he can lead, but she can't. And she's offering to pay it back. We had to push him to pay back his money. You know, Paula Bennett's been suspiciously quiet on this entire thing, and it could be because there's a few questions around her own behaviour when she was a beneficiary. What about all these other MPs that have been in the past that are suddenly all quiet? You know, it's and you know, they don't want people to investigate too far in their own investments and what they're up to. And it seems that the Todd Barclay affair seems to have disappeared. He's sitting back in Parliament, sitting pretty, while everyone is attacking the opposition. But he was very constructive and bullying and getting rid of a loyal office person who had been working for them for many, many years. So, you know, if we're going to lay the blame at the poor, let's also get a balance and look at what the rich are doing.
Now, the president of Uruguay just came out recently, I think it was yesterday, saying that the rich should be banned from politics. And, and I was like, never even thought of that concept before. And then my mind started clicking it over, the gears start turning, and I'm like, uh-huh, that'll work. Oh, my God, he's right. If you've got a hell of a lot of money and a hell of a lot of privilege, you don't give a F about people. You can't be their leader and be their leader.
Well, look what's happening with Trump at the moment. I mean, he's mixed his business interests, his family interests, with being president. I think it's not so much that the rich shouldn't be leading, but the rich should not be benefiting. If they own companies, if they own businesses, if their partners own businesses and companies, they should not be allowed to apply or be on any trust that makes a decision around any contracts. It influences, as soon as someone knows that Judith Collins' wife or husband, I think I call him wife, if her husband has got a company that wants water rights, that wants our Totara swamp, our Cody swamp, I think it is, Cody, yes, our Cody swamp, and make money out of it, he should not be allowed. His company should not be allowed to contract. We have to separate their personal interests, financial interests, business interests from them being a representative of this country. And the lobby groups, we need to know who they are. We need to know why they're lobbying certain parties and giving them money. We should not be allowing donations coming from companies to particular parties if it is that they're doing it to lobby. We should be banning those type of corporate donations. Let's make it fair across the board that all parties have the right to, you know, do what they do, but they shouldn't be receiving donations from the wealthy and from the corporations who then go on to influence. And I'm reminded of the case of Liu, who he was the guy, the Chinese guy who paid to come into New Zealand because he's wealthy. And then what he did is he turned around and committed a crime, and then he was expecting National Party to back him up, you know, and get away with it. He shouldn't be allowed to do that. And the problem you've got is a lot of these immigrants are coming in from countries where paying a minister is normal. We have to get rid of that culture. We can't have that culture in New Zealand. Well, it has to go.
One person I saw posting up a petition about all of these things that you need to really be worried about, you know, the environment, biology, and the politics, and the money, and the economy, and the so on and so forth, and all these things that are really important to New Zealand. And I said to her, well, where's the alcoholism ignoring reality on that list as well? I thought we were talking about New Zealand.
Well, you know, I remember Muldoon calling a snap election when he was drunk. And I think Winston was his junior whip at that time drinking. I think he learnt how to drink the whiskey on him too. We have a unique opportunity to make New Zealand stand out as a non-corrupt country. It used to stand out for that. But I can't say we're the same anymore. We've Americanized ourselves so much that it's blurred the lines. And I think what we've got to do is come back to not blurring the lines. And that's what will make the difference.
Now, in order to have a country that doesn't have corruption, we'd need to have something called a corruption prevention framework. For example,
yes.
If under the Local Government Act, just for example, if you procure a contract and you don't tell them what the scope of the contract is, what the value of that contract is, and what the contract's even about, and it's not available for public scrutiny
exactly.
or anything like that, how are you going to prevent corruption? You can't.
Now, we need an independent corruption board.
Now, we don't even have rules for the judges. We don't have any rules for the politicians. We don't have any rules for the councillors. We don't have any rules for the police. We don't have any rules for any section of society in New Zealand that actually holds any power. Now, that's what's problematic about it, is that democracy doesn't work if the powerful are not kept in check. And that's what journalism is actually about, is about telling people,
we need an anti-corruption system. And we don't have that. We need an independent anti-corruption authority that can oversee any whiff of corruption, any taste of corruption. And that needs to be independent. It needs to be non-politically appointed. It needs to be appointed from an independent panel that crosses all parties so that it becomes an equal decision of who sits on there. The problem we've got is there's been far too many politically biased appointments. I sit on a tribunal. The last 9 years, it's been all National Party appointments that even the chairperson has had no say in. And that becomes dangerous because you've got to have the variation of voices and skills and mindset so that you're not getting that nepotism that exists, where if a question comes in about the National Party or whatever party's in power, that we're able to independently assess it without bias. We can't do that. When ministries bully the chairperson to keep me off because they are threatened by my sitting on their cases, then we have to question, where is their ability to be unbiased? You know, I do my best to be unbiased by sitting there and saying I want to hear both sides of the story. Why can they not trust that? Because I think they have so much corruption within the ministries as well that they are too scared of anyone that could evolve it or expose it or be able to make it public.
For every one of us, to have that. For every one of us that strikes at the branches of tyranny, there are very few that strike at the root. And it behooves us, I think, to pay attention specifically to the things that make us feel uncomfortable, for the things that we don't like, for the things that we don't agree with. Those are the things that are actually more important to listen to and understand than the things we do support and we do like, because that puts in our own bias. And if we are capable of listening to everybody about everything, then we're capable of making a holistic decision based upon all available information rather than a belief structure based upon an ideological cul-de-sac called Rogernomics.
And, you know, it's okay to disagree with something and still be able to support it because it's fair to be across the board representing everyone. And I'll take the America's Cup as a point in hand. I know that the Pride weeks don't get anywhere near $400,000. That would actually cover 3 Pride events over 3 years. And yet overnight they found $400,000 for the America's Cup win to do the parades, right? I don't support the America's Cup. I think it's a rich man's game and shouldn't be the taxpayer or the ratepayer covering those costs. It should be private enterprise only because it is a private enterprise sport. However, the majority wanted it, so we got it. Now, that's fair, but how about giving us a little bit of reciprocity? Why aren't we dealing with the homelessness with that $400,000? Why are we not supporting other non-sports? Why is it we don't televise Paralympics or don't televise disability sports? Why is it we don't televise women's sports as fairly or as much as men's sports? So why should I, as a woman who's disabled, why should I have to support that sport when very few Māori are involved, very few women, well, no women are really involved in the front line of it? Why do I have to support that, but they can't support my interests, which are disability, Māori, social justice interests? Why do I not get that support? Why is it we can give the All Blacks guys a whole bunch of preening, flash clothes, labelled clothing, first class accommodation, but we can't do that for our female Silver Ferns or for any of the other sports? Why is it that we're so unbalanced in what we support? And that's the issue. We lose 1.2 billion a year in congested travel in Auckland alone because we're one third of the population, yet the rest of the country doesn't want us to be investing in public transport or in proper, you know, infrastructure, and yet we're at a crisis level here. But, oh, no, let's pay for motels at $2,500 a week for people who are homeless because we're not going to improve the infrastructure in New Zealand for housing, for travel, for transport. But we don't mind shoring them up and wasting money that way because that's easier than fixing the systemic cause of it. We fix the symptoms, we don't fix the cause. And that's our modus operandi in New Zealand, and it's a real problem.
When the Roman Empire was collapsing, they had these great spectacle games in the Colosseum. And the gladiators were treated even better than senators, and they were the yes. highest paid people in the entire empire, even higher paid than the emperor himself. They were given their own personal masseuse. They were given luxury accommodation. They were given as many prostitutes as they wanted. They were taken care of as though they were the most valued livestock that has ever lived. And the reason why they were taken such good care of is because the population was crumbling. Society was crumbling. And the only way that they could keep people from realizing that fact is to distract them from somebody they could be inherently entertained by and inherently jealous of at the same time.
Absolutely. And that's the stupidity of it. You know, we're quite prepared to have rodeos and, you know, to abuse animals and abuse people in certain sports and things. We're quite prepared to have boxing matches and violent sports, but we're not prepared to support people in housing. We're not prepared to support medicinal cannabis. I mean, I'm quite sure a few of those violent sports, they wouldn't mind a bit of that balm. You know, support the core basic functions of health and wellness for our communities, but we're quite prepared to entertain them while they're poor and suffering. We're quite prepared to put a lot of money into entertainment sports, but we're not prepared to help people to be well themselves so that they themselves can engage in healthy pursuits. We've got our priorities upside down right now, and it's killing us. It's killing our community. It's killing the underlying focus of what we used to be in New Zealand. I grew up in a community, and it wasn't perfect, don't get me wrong, but I grew up in a New Zealand that was far more egalitarian than it is now. We didn't have class. I didn't even know about class until really the right wing started taking over and showed me what class was. I didn't know we had differences. My dad was a social worker and a prison officer, so I knew those communities, but it wasn't like it is now. We have lost it. We've Americanized ourselves, corporatized ourselves, and they think we can survive like that. We can't. We must have the Maslow's hierarchy, the basic concepts of what we need to survive in that infrastructure so every New Zealander has the access to a home, to food, to the ability to self-finance. We can't do that at the moment with 92,000 unemployed, unskilled youth. And we're bringing in foreign workers to replace them because, according to our Prime Minister, they're lazy. But is it that they don't have housing? They're struggling with their sexuality. They're struggling with a whole bunch of things. And they can't afford to go into training. They can't afford any of those things. Is it because we're not supporting them? You know, and I know that personally. My son, when he was a teenager, couldn't get work. And he's mildly disabled. But I made him go and do voluntary work. And then I made him go and go to a shop or go to a company and say, I will work for you for free for a week, and you can see if I've got the skills. And he got jobs, and now he's in stable employment, earning a pretty decent amount for a guy that lacks a formal qualification. And, you know, it's possible, but you've got to put time and effort into those kids. They lose hope in a very quick time when they can't get work. I never missed out on work at his age. There was no shortage of work when I was going through that time, but there is now. And instead of vilifying them, we need to support them.
The government of New Zealand, before the time of Muldoon and Rogernomics, actually used to pay out an enormous amount when somebody lost their job, specifically because when you lose your job, you lose your income, and that has a flow-on effect on society, starting with your family and ending with your nutrition, and the participation in society was specifically what the government wanted to ensure, because when you can't continue to go to the movies, go out with your friends to have a drink at the bar or something of that nature, you start to feel very depressed. And because the benefits were so high in New Zealand and we had a 0% unemployment rate, anybody who received a benefit after receiving their job felt so guilty about it that they immediately started job hunting. And because they had their full income, they could afford the gas to go to those interviews, they could afford the time to, and the phone calls and all of that kind of stuff, and it was beautiful. Now, that's what egalitarian is. What we have now is egoitarian, where the ego is eating itself because it's become so freaking huge.
Absolutely. Totally agree. And that's the issue we have. And, you know, people are also much easier to spread out an uninformed voice and comment than it is to spread out an informed, researched voice and comment. These days, alternative facts, fake news, uninformed opinions are becoming the norm, and the researched, informed, knowledgeable voices are becoming the abnormal. And that's a sad part too.
In a sane world, in an insane world, a sane man must appear insane. Now, people don't actually follow that through to its logical conclusion. My conclusion is that the world is run by insane people for insane ends, much like John Lennon said back in the 1960s. What's an insane person, ladies and gentlemen? A frickin' psychopath or a malignant narcissist? Somebody who has the exact opposite motivation to what in New Zealand we call a GC, which is a good hunt. You know, well, that's the rhyme of it. you know, like this is the kind of thing we're doing. And you go, what's the psychopathic mindset, and how does that lay up with every single policy that the government ever passes, the way every single organization seems to treat its workers and so on? It's, it's a psychopathic control grid. It suddenly makes so much sense to me.
I just think, you know, people need to get sensible, and I think in the context of medicinal cannabis, there's a lot of fear mongers. And they are dominating. And the thing is, they're fearmongers based on uninformed information. And they really need to start listening. And we need to get real. As I said before, what is wrong with an 80-year-old woman or an 80-year-old guy grabbing a balm and using that, and it's got CBD oil in it? You know, what is wrong with that? What's wrong with them having a couple of pieces of shortbread at night that's an edible, or a little bit of chocolate or a bit of fudge? Why not enjoy your medicine, I say? You know, there's nothing worse than having to take a drug that has a bitter taste in it at nighttime and you want to go to sleep, or has side effects that destroy your liver and your kidneys. Whereas overnight, if you just take a medicinal balm or a medicinal cookie and you go to sleep and you wake up in the morning and there's no ill effects, you know? Yeah, we've got to talk sensibly about this and stop this emotional overload of fake information and start getting real. And I do. I challenge Bill English. I challenge all of those MPs that are opposed to sit down and have a conversation about why they're opposed. And then sit down with people like myself and say, well, why is it working? And what can we do to make it so that the effects of any drug overdose or any drug abuse is limited? Because there is a tiny, tiny population group who will react to it negatively. But that happens with every substance. There's always somebody that's allergic. Someone, in the same way that morphine, you know, causes allergies in some people.
Well, it's like I always say, some people shouldn't drink and some people shouldn't smoke weed. But fortunately, neither of those people.
Well, you see, I shouldn't drink. I do not make a very nice drunk.
Well, it reminds me of what Billy T. James says about it. Well, I'm half Maori and I'm half Scottish, so half of me likes to drink and the other half doesn't like to pay for it.
Yep, exactly. And I think that's the note, hey? It's, I remember smoking when I was a teenager. I did try cannabis and I loved the after effect. But then when I had my son, got into my studies, I didn't have time or energy for it. But I've got to say, I've been on it now for 2 years almost, and it works. And I haven't been stoned once, but it does work, and it works well. And I've got to say that I'm now totally convinced that that is a medicine that is natural and will have it. And it's a bit like rongoā medicine. If we want to make an analogy, it's like having a kawakawa drink or a poultice put on a wound. It heals. Manuka honey heals. And so does medicinal cannabis. It heals. So does CBD, which is now legal, but we don't have the products in New Zealand yet. But that heals. And we need to be looking at what heals, and let's stop being afraid and have those conversations.
Well, what's problematic is that if you're having a conversation with somebody who has a hidden agenda and a financial interest in not having that conversation, it makes it slightly more difficult. And particularly if that person doesn't have a conscience and has a track record of being completely dishonest. But yeah, this is a difficulty when you're an honest person who has a conscience. We mistakenly believe that everybody's like that. They're not. There are people who do not think like they do.
Todd Barclay was a tobacco lobbyist, and look where he's ended up. Let's just talk about the case in point. No lobbyists should be having access where they can unduly influence. But citizens can argue a point if they want to, but not a tobacco company, not companies. Companies need to not be allowed to do that political lobbying. That should not be allowed. But citizens who see the benefit in something should have the right to be able to lobby.
Mm.
For me personally, if I could ban alcohol tomorrow, I would, because of the destruction it's caused my family and all of that. However, I'm aware that some people don't have those problems, so why should I make that prohibitive? Because all that does is make it underground, everybody does their home brew.
When Prohibition actually first kicked off in the United States, the level of alcoholism and damage from alcohol that was happening to people skyrocketed absolutely massively. Now, what happened to the amount of damage that was being done to people when cannabis was made illegal? It started to go up massively, not because of the drug itself, but because of the organized crime that started to make money off of an illegal black market product. Now, here's the thing. Bill English, Peter Dunne, whomsoever can make this decision, understand this. Every moment that you keep cannabis illegal, not only are people suffering and dying as a direct result of your decisions, but you have no excuse to do what you're doing, all right? That's the ultimate thing. There is the consequences of your actions and the fact that there is no justification in them. And people need to understand that dynamic.
Yep. And I think that's the thing. I think a lot of them, and they're my generation, so I would take it down to the education of Reefer Madness, which came out under FBI and CIA and how they tried to basically demonize people of color in America. And by criminalizing them and finding an excuse, they had a workforce that they could have for free and keep them in some form of indentured slavery, which is their modern prisons, their private prisons in particular. And the same problem in New Zealand, when we have the majority of people in prison are Māori, and like 51.3% of men in prison are Māori, and 53.something% of women in prison are Māori. And a lot of it is for non-violent offences. Mm. And a lot of it is drugs and alcohol, stealing for drugs and alcohol, things that they shouldn't need to be in jail for, but things where we could work with them to educate them, help them, and by decriminalizing, charge a fine. You know, if someone's out smoking on the street and they're smoking around children, charge them a fine. If they're smoking in their own home, leave them alone. You know, but it's this... It inevitably, any of this prohibition is going to have a harder effect on Indigenous peoples, people of colour, poor people, marginalised people than it does on the corporates, the rich and the white. Mm-hmm. And that's the reality. When I work on the North Shore, I had a staff member who's since resigned, a Pākehā woman, and she turned around and said to me, just make it illegal. She said, I smoke with the judges, the lawyers, I smoke with all these highbrow people all the time. It's okay, just smoke. And I looked at her and I said, I live in South Auckland. And I'm Māori. I can't, because I will be stopped. I will be arrested. She openly smokes them. I said, I know. I was a lawyer. I know how many lawyers out there are using this stuff. How many out there are using the harder stuff? How many of them are alcoholics and drink themselves to death? How many judges out there use it? There's lots of them. It's hypocritical because they don't speak out. But the citizens like myself who have no power in the structure speaks out. Those, they don't, and they use it all the time.
Because they've got something to lose. They got something to lose.
They have.
All right. They value their...
But I'm not going to be quiet.
Well, this is the difference between you and me and these people, all right, is that we know we've got something to lose, but we understand that what we can lose is nothing by comparison to what society loses if we do nothing.
Exactly. We lose much greater than they will ever lose. And, I mean, I have to laugh because I remember the time when the high-profile actors, I think it was, or comedians or whatever were up on, or high-profile Kiwis were up on big drug charges. All the lawyers I knew were scrambling. We all knew about who it was and what was happening way before it went in the media, because our own little legal network was telling everyone, half of them are bloody users themselves. So, I mean, you know, it reeks of hypocrisy. And the whole reason why I came public is I did not want to reek of that hypocrisy. I decided that if I'm going to do this, then I will let them know, because you've got to make a stand. Someone has to make a stand somewhere, because it is an unjust law that exists right now, and that we have an obligation. And I know that it was said by one of the presidents, who himself was a bit corrupt, but it was also said by Martin Luther King Jr., is that if you do, that it is our obligation, our duty, to break an unjust law. So I guess I'm more and more in line. I'm uncomfortable with it. I don't like going to a lot of the J-Days and things, because I'm uncomfortable with recreational, but I don't interfere or say anything, because that's their journey. But honestly, we should be openly allowed to be able to follow our conscience when it comes to having rights to access medicinal cannabis. And now I would say recreational.
Now, to the lawyers and doctors and all you addicts out there, how ironic do you find it that somebody who is in a wheelchair is making a stand when you don't?
Well, you know, maybe they're afraid of their incomes being affected. But you know what? They wouldn't lose respect. People would gain higher respect for them if they spoke out. People would grow to respect them. And I'll tell you what now, if I had a doctor that spoke out or a lawyer that spoke out and I needed their services, I would go to that lawyer, that doctor. I won't go to those who hide behind the truth and then try and demonise me for wanting to access that very same product.
That's indeed, you know, true. One time that I remember the effect of cannabis, and I'll never forget it, is when my mate Barry, who has MS like you, not anywhere near as bad as your condition is at this point, though, but we were walking up Queen Street, and he hadn't had a smoke that day. And So I had a little bit on me, so I gave him a pipe, and then all of a sudden I was actually having trouble catching up with him. You know, he was just moving up that street faster than me, and it was like, oh my God. And see, that's the thing. Smoking is an instant thing. It's like intravenous, but it just instantly has that effect. That's why it's so good for instant pain relief for those people who suffer chronic conditions.
Absolutely, and it's very effective for neuropathic pain, which is very endemic in MS anyway, and it's extremely effective. And I mean, I'm at the point where once I've gotten rid of this lung infection, where I feel well enough to get on a walker again and start exercising at home to strengthen my leg muscles again. Now, I'm not saying it's not a cure, don't get me wrong, I'm still progressing. But I may be able to strengthen my leg muscles so I can keep myself more ambulant than what I do right now, more mobile. And that is directly a result of using medicinal cannabis. It's not the result of using any of the pharmaceuticals, because they're hopeless. The side effects on those things are that they will kill you. If they don't kill you straight away, they'll kill you through damaging your liver, your kidneys, or your heart, or whatever other organ. So I would rather, if I'm going to die, I'd rather die happy than I'd die in pain.
Yeah. Well, I always thought it would be interesting to have a warning label on your cannabis. Warning, consumption may make you happy, hungry, thirsty, and sleepy. Just like, there you
well,
go.
Well, even the myth of hunger, like, yeah, if you smoke it, I think you will, because the THC, the psychoactive side, will make you hungry. But I've actually lost 21 kilos, and I've gone from pre-diabetic to non-diabetic. And so that comes directly down to not filling my body up with opiates, steroids, which gave me a huge hankering for sugar. And sugar's really addictive. And I actually don't really enjoy much sugar anymore. I might have a couple of chocolate bars a week, but that's a treat. And I find I can't eat the whole thing at once. I have to break it down, whereas I used to gobble those things like lollies. And so it changes what's going on inside. I can't even explain it. And Sativex didn't even do that. Well, you know, yeah, but what happened with Sativex, it's very pharmaceutically altered. It's still cannabis, but it's got alcohol spray, it's got peppermint oil, and, you know, and it's not quite as effective as Tilray, which is just grapeseed oil, cannabis oil. But what I've noticed with Tilray is that things are healing inside. I can feel my, you know, I'm getting normal digestion now. I'm getting normal body function now. I don't crave anymore. I don't even snack very much in between. And so what's happening is my body is slowly rejigging itself back into a normal function. It's not going to cure me, but it's going to give me a chance of having good health for a lot longer than I have now.
Indeed. Dr. Huhana Hickey has been my guest, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for spending the time with me today, sweetheart. It's been absolutely wonderful and beautiful and fantastic and various other nice
such objectives. A pleasure.
Yeah, I get that effect on people. Now, ladies and gentlemen, please go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and donate today to support real media that actually tell you the truth and expose the corrupt scumbaggery media that just fucking don't. All right. We'll see you after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with the Anarchy Girl. Hi, folks. I'm Vinnie Eastwood from the Vinnie Eastwood Show. The first and only New Zealander in history to be offered a talk radio show on an American network. For nearly 10 years, I've worked hard to help people's voices be heard. Created the largest online archive of protests, public meetings, and long-form interviews with activists in New Zealand history. Revealing the hidden and uncomfortable truths of our time that no corporate media will air. On this show, you will hear directly from the activists, journalists, and fringe researchers about every topic and belief structure imaginable. No taboo topics, no fear of doom, and only one rule: have fun. After all, just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point? Thousands of hours of free audio and video content with almost any guest on practically any subject you can imagine is available right now for free. Why? Because people all over the world have been giving me a few dollars a month. Many have been giving $5 a week, others $10 and $20, each according to their means. Some so generous as to donate $100 a month with one specific instruction. Just keep doing what you're doing, Vinny. This show has changed and in some cases literally saved lives. There are people who live today who would have taken their own life had it not been for the good humour and mind-blowing conversations with some of the most brilliant people on the planet to remind us that there is a lighter side to genocide, and the only thing worse than the New World Order is the jokes of Vinnie Eastwood.